Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to session A20, Loving God Intimately, worship with Anaheim Vineyard Fellowship in 1977 to 1983. We opened with the beginning of a evening worship service in 1982. Sounds like it was familiar to some. My name is Carrie Steenwick. I'm the Publications Manager for the Worship Institute here at Calvin. And as part of my work for that, I've been working as co-editor with Lester Ruth, who will give you a minute to introduce himself, on a book series called The Church at Worship. And we are here looking at one of the communities that will be focused in an upcoming volume in that series, which will be the Anaheim Vineyard in this 1980s-ish time period. And to help us with that and to tell us about their experiences with this congregation, we have Cindy Rethmeyer and Andy Park. I'd like to give the three of you an opportunity to introduce yourself, if you want to comment on the service in that introduction or your experience with it. I'd welcome that as well.
I'm Cindy. I remember that service, and that's pretty common. Even just, it's so funny to hear sweet to hear John playing Rhodes, and to imagine him sitting behind that piano. He used to play and then stand up and just start teaching. And then also the way that Carl moves from song to song, because he just never really took a break. That was just the way that he led back then. Anyway, so now I'm at an Anglican church as the worship pastor, along with Todd Hunter, who is also someone that was back. Well, he probably agreed if I went to church, but I met him in 1979. And ended up being over Church,
and I'm Andy Park, and at the time of that service, I was in West LA at the vineyard there. The pastor of that church was good friends with Limber, and we used to visit Anaheim. And I did those same songs that we just heard in my church, and so I was on staff at Anaheim Vineyard from 92 to 98. But I traveled with Limber beginning in the early 80s all over. And so I guess because I was on staff and because there wasn't anybody else available to help put this volume together, I contributed to it. And now I'm in British Columbia, where I've been for a long time with my family, and I'm helping out with a new church plant there. So,
thank you.
I'm Lester Ruth, and I'm not affiliated with Calvin. I normally teach at Duke University, and these two fine folks are—they're underestimating their historic importance and their contribution to this book. Actually, it's not just simply that there was no one else to help put the volume together. Their level of familiarity and intimacy with these early years and everyone involved was absolutely invaluable to put together this particular volume. Even if I could just comment on this tape, I'm a worship historian by training and job. This is the sort of historic artifact that historians salivate over. Because you can get a real feel for what the worship's actually like.
And he does. He's been talking about this tape a lot.
If you saw it, I was singing along with every song because I've listened to it so much. I've got the tape memorized.
During our session today, we want to have most of our time in conversation with Cindy and Andy. But before we do that, I'm going to talk briefly about the series and then introduce the congregation, help us place it historically, and show a few pictures and hear a little bit more of the music. And if you want to jump in and comment on anything along the way, please do so. The series, I'm going to pass around the books that are currently out. It's the Church at Worship series, which is a group of case studies. Each volume looks at one particular church in one particular time and place to examine their worshiping documents, their sermons, their songs, their theology documents, polity documents, pictures, and
audio as we have it available, to give people a taste of what worship might have been like if we picked you up and dropped you in that time and place. It's kind of a travelogue. So I'll pass these around. We currently have out Jerusalem in the 4th century, Constantinople in the 6th century, and Church of Christ Holiness USA in Jackson, Mississippi, around 1900. What you'll notice when you look at them is they're organized in three parts. The first part will give you sort of a sense of background, be able to place the community historically, liturgically, geographically, an introduction to what's going on. But just like our session today, most of that middle section, which is by far the biggest, is primary sources, is hearing from the people. And then the last section is application and glossary, index, some of those traditional things. But the application is also interesting because they're small group study questions. So people could use these in a church setting. Or devotional questions. Others have worshipped with these texts. Are there ways that they can enhance our worship? So as you pass them around, take a glance through. This volume is coming up. It'll either be the next one out, hopefully within a year, or the second one out. We are also working on a volume on Calvin's Geneva right now, which one of them will be next, and one will be the one farther out from that.
And the volume after that will be Isaac Watts, the 18th century hymn writer, who's also a pastor in his congregation in London in the early 18th century.
And we present these in each of these case studies in much the same way as sort of our conversation today, where we're not holding up any of these volumes and saying, your church should be this church. Instead, what we'd like to do, and we'd invite you to do as you're listening today, is listen for opportunities to say, blessed is the church that, or wise is the church that, and learn from, find things from your context that would connect with what we're hearing and seeing. How can your church grow and be enriched by some of the practices that we hear stories about today?
So where'd you get recordings of the Constantinople?
We don't have that. This is actually currently the only one that we actually have audio files for.
Well, I was going to say eBay, but I think her answer is more accurate and truthful. So,
do you want to comment at all on how we picked the volume, or shall we go into a brief history?
Let me just comment a little bit. As we were working here to put together the kind of the scheme for the entire series, and we were hoping to do at least 10 of these volumes, there were particular times and places that we thought were our hunch or our knowledge was that these were especially crucial or would be very instructive. And so one of the things we wanted to take a look at is find a good example of what, like Donald Miller, the USC sociologist, calls a new paradigm church, a new way of worship, a new way of being church that arose in the 1960s and 1970s. As we began to scout through the literature, we came across a really fine study on the Vineyard, Bill Jackson's study. And conversations there eventually led to us teaming up and us settling on this Anaheim Vineyard congregation. The key with any of the volumes is finding a church for which we can find a strong enough paper trail.
I'm going to quickly go through a bunch of dates just to help us have a sense of what part of Vineyard history we're looking at. We're going to jump in at about 1976, which is when the Anaheim Vineyard, this congregation, sort of got started. It got started as a home worship group of friends, Quakers, in Yorba Linda. You may want to note that John Wimber wasn't actually in that group when it first started, but he joined shortly after, and within a very short time began leading it. You'll notice even just by looking at those two dates, very shortly thereafter, it looks like a month or so, they begin worshiping as Calvary Chapel of Yorba Linda with John Wimber as the pastor. There was enormous growth in the first several years.
And following that growth, there's a lot of movement of the congregation, from a junior high to a high school to a bigger high school, to accommodate these ever-expanding numbers. In the early 80s, the congregation leaves the Calvary Chapel and joins Vineyard, which previously existed. Even though we often associate the Anaheim Vineyard Fellowship with sort of the Vineyard, they weren't the group that actually started the Vineyard. In 1982, John Wimber serves as the executive producer for the first album, All the Earth Shall Worship. And we'll hear, I think we may not hear songs from that.
No.
But maybe one if I still have that in there.
We kept that. Yeah,
we kept
that. Song.
As far as worship emphasis, there's a focus on new music, but not simply new music for the purpose of new music, but a new music that sort of changed the way that we expressed ourselves to God. There's a focus on singing to God in loving, intimate language, simple ways that can be learned quickly. There's an interest in spiritual gifts.
Let me stop you right there. I'm sorry, Carrie. The one preposition that's there, two songs to God, is critically important for this congregation. Not just songs about God, but songs to God, and so there's a directness in much of the music.
Especially healing, and I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to hear some stories about that later. There's an informal way of being church and a pragmatic approach to evangelizing, going out and doing on the street corner what they're doing in church. So here's a few pictures to kind of place us. This is worshiping in one of the high schools, I think, right, Cindy?
Canyon High School?
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about how to the right over there you can see the wood. That was bleachers. So they pushed them back. And then we faced that way because we were trying to face away from this huge Indian mascot. So on the wall, it was gigantic. So we turned that way. We didn't have a choice later on because the congregation got so big that we just couldn't do it anymore. We couldn't face that way. So I can see my husband.
Where is he?
It's right. Well, actually, that's my brother-in-law, right? Up there. And then I think my husband's right next to him.
You can see some of the informality here and how people are dressed. You can see the different types of expression. You can also notice that the area that the music is led from is not very elevated. They're down worshiping among the people.
And look at the demographics of the people. That what appears just to be the average age of a participant there.
Go back
one. The Comanche is just to the right, over there.
This is John Wimber. I think Cindy mentioned earlier that he would be playing at the keyboard and then start leading, preaching from that spot. One aspect that was very important is the prayer ministry, and both leadership praying, but also the people within the congregation praying for each other. And you can see here little pockets of people praying.
Sometimes when the prayer, he would break the service up and we'd end up praying for people before the teaching went on. And if people still need prayer, there's a room to right over here, and they would go through that room, and it was a wait room. So they'd go back there, and that was where all the ministry kept happening.
It's
Lonnie Frisbee up there.
Oh, with the beard.
Yeah.
And this is not actually from the Anaheim Vineyard, but this is from one of the early trips to England, say 81, 82-ish, 83-ish, Cindy? Mm-hmm. And you were on this trip, right?
Yeah.
So can you speak just a moment about, what?
If you go back to the other one, one of the values was that instead of Donna, he's on the right here, praying for that person, she's helping and blessing somebody else as they pray for that person that's standing there, and you can see how young she is. And the reason that we did that when we went out to conferences was to say, this is for the people. This is a lay ministry, so everybody can be a part of this. Everyone can do this. And John used to say, everyone can play. So this was her praying for this girl, and then the girl praying for the person who was coming up for ministry. And she might have been getting prayer there, too. So, anyway, it would have been all, that circle would have been happening all over the world. Yeah, and that's the same thing. And she's laying hands, because we asked always, can we lay hands on you? And they'd say, you know, hopefully yes. If not, it didn't matter, but anyway, that was a yes. So, with your hand there and laying on of hands, that was why. There's Lonnie, standing up probably on a pew that he wasn't supposed to stand on.
But could you just give a little bit of background, description of who he is and his role in that?
Lonnie came one time to the church, and he gave his message that was pre-scattered, and I have no idea what he said, except that I remember him giving us his grandma's address to write her a letter. It's a very interesting message. Anyways, at the end of it, he called up everybody who was 25 and under, and so there was this huge group of people in the front, because I'd say about half of the church was 25 and under. And then he stood up front and he just took his hands like this, and he asked the Holy Spirit to come. And he took his hands and he just went like this, and it was as if everybody was dominoes, and they just started falling down all the way in front of them, just falling to the ground. And some of them speaking tongues that had never spoken in tongues before. It was wild. So anyway, they went down, and when that happened, John thought, oh my gosh, I've made a terrible mistake. Because what he saw from the piano looking out was that out of the rest of the congregation, about a third of people got up and walked out. Because it was something we had never seen before. So that was a shifting point. Lonnie created a turning point for us as a church. And then after that, John received a phone call from one of his friends in another city, in Denver actually, and he said, I don't know what's happened with you, but the Lord woke me up and said to tell you it's him. And so John said, okay. And then, that's
when,
really what's happening.
When people... some of the concerned members of the church asked him, how far are you going to let this go? He said, no farther than this book, the Bible. Because if you look in the Bible, there's a lot of weird things that happen that are initiated by God. So that's what he meant by that.
Yeah.
I'll inject myself and put on my historian hat again. Lonnie Frisbee is one of the most significant figures of the 1970s and through the 1980s. If you've heard of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, all the Jesus people, Lonnie is the one that helped Chuck Smith at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, make inroads with the hippie subculture there in Southern California and help establish the start of the revival and the ministry there at Calvary Chapel.
So we included here some of the sounds. This is one of the songs that we requested that we that we include.
Wonderful, wonderful is the Lord.
Cindy, can you give us the backstory on where that recording actually took place?
It's in the bathroom at the Wagner House. We had this building that we bought that was where we had the offices because we didn't have a church building, right? So we met in high school, and so they purchased a building where we could hold seminars. We had healing seminars there and all kinds of things. Actually, my friends and I, we cooked our Thanksgiving dinner there one time. Had our families out there. It had this beautiful kitchen and all this, but then in the back had this huge bathroom. It was all tile. And so it had the best acoustics.
Carrie, could you go back and let's get a picture of, well, first, notice the simplicity of the lyrics and the call and response nature, and then go back to the picture of the worship space itself. Go back another one. Go back. That one. Notice what you don't see. You don't see any projection, do you? And you don't see anybody holding anything to get the lyrics in their hands. And the reason for that is? The lyrics weren't projected or given to anyone.
Right. I mean, they were such simple songs.
The simplicity of the songs and the call and response really facilitate the singing, I think.
And it was before the age of everybody and their brother does worship recordings. It was before the age of the explosion of contemporary music worship scene. So a very, very small amount of music was being released each year. Comparatively.
Yeah, it was easy to know. Obviously.
So you didn't, there wasn't, like it is today, that you have thousands of songs to choose from.
This is actually from a training tape that would have been distributed.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk
they
about
started
that?
The tape, Carl started the tape tuning his guitar so that people could tune along with him and then play.
For use to train the kinship group worship leaders, the small group home base.
Small group leaders were the ones who wanted those.
You'll probably recognize this one, too.
Oh, let the Son of God enthrone with His Spirit and His love. Let Him fill your heart and satisfy your soul. Oh, Chuck Smith's radio program featured that song every time. So that song was heard millions and millions of times.
Yeah. It was a big song for us. That was.
Calvary Chapel was a huge movement of churches that spawned the Vineyard and had a very prominent radio Bible teaching program.
Did you have a question?
Probably in the 1980s. I heard this in Spanish. Do you have some in the Spanish website or songs Singing in the Spanish?
I don't know particularly where to find that one. There are a lot of vineyard songs translated into Spanish. I have a
any tape.
There's a CD. I have a CD of some of my songs in Spanish. It's here this week. But that's just one tiny little piece. If you go to the Vineyard Music website, you'll find different CDs in Spanish.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that you're saying that you heard it in 1980, is if you think about it, there was no internet back then, right? So the songs were going out in around the world.
It was in Peru.
Okay.
I know.
Right. So
right.
It's going around the world. It went around the world so quickly, all those songs did with no internet.
Yeah.
So it was pretty amazing.
And in Singapore, it was Evie Tonquist who brought it.
Oh, really?
The recording.
Right, yeah,
I
remember her
saying
that.
Connect
yeah.
This
yeah.
To add to that, in 86 we were singing this in Dutch, and that was actually one of the very first vineyard songs that was used at a Dutch reform youth meet.
Wow.
And really, we were singing it over and over late at night and just worshiping.
Yeah.
And for us, it was a completely new experience of like, we can worship God this way.
Go ahead.
Hi,
can you take the slide back 1 second? I've always known it as, let the Son of God enfold you.
I might have missed a word.
Yeah.
I was trying to get the words
yeah.
in here quickly.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
throwing them in here just before we came in.
So,
and it's interesting to note that this is an exception to the norm of what Lester pointed out, that we emphasize I to you, like singing directly in the first person to the Lord. This is speaking to the people. Or speaking to one another, sing to one another the songs, hymns, and spiritual songs. But the effect really is the same, the effect of communion with God and receiving the Holy Spirit and His encouragement is the same.
I think the tenderness of these words is something as well. You know, just knowing that that is true and taking that on and believing it. And I think there was something about not having to look at words up front and being able to close your eyes and just listen to what was being sung or said or that you were singing, that again spoke to the intimacy that was felt.
Some of those.
One more question. Sorry, it's about filling your lamps. Was that a theological issue in many churches? Because that must be a new concept at that time, would it not?
Mm.
Filling of the Spirit and stuff like that. Did you face any?
Well, it's just a simple picture of we're part of the flock of God, you know, and so be continually filled with the Spirit. That idea, I don't think. There's plenty of other things that were controversial, but that particular idea and in this particular song, I don't remember that.
Just a question: since so many of the songs are transmitted orally. Places, people picking them up and passing them along. Did you see variations of lyric and melody happening anywhere? And what could you do about it?
Yeah.
Or was it unprompted?
Yeah, a lot of times you just can't do anything. Like if a local congregation learns it one way, hopefully it's not too far off from. One place, that, I mean, since we just had different people from different countries mentioning it, they get translated. You know, inaccurately often, and people miss the nuances that actually are pretty important. But it's a very difficult thing to control.
Especially back then. I mean, it was a big, far apart world, whereas now it's so connected, right?
In Spanish, they translate Cristo, not Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
That's what's
Suceder. Yeah.
I've really had this question for about
30
years.
30
years?
So crank up the volume a little bit.
So I became a Christian when I was 70, and I was classically trained. And what
what's always astounded me about this, and I see the beginnings on it now, I wonder, did this music come sort of out of the drug culture where everything was slowing down? Because hymns, you know, were just sung by so many old people who were rip-roaring fast. And then in comes this, and it's so slow. And to this day, in our church, the contemporary is just so slow. And the I've just always wondered, where did that come from?
I think it's a combination of influences. I actually, when he was leading that song, I thought, that is incredibly slow.
It is.
The recorded version of that song that was on Chuck Smith's radio program, way faster.
Yeah.
But even if I listened to a recording I did in, like, the 80s, I think, oh my gosh, that's slow. You know, so, I think one key factor there is that, you know, if you sing a song like this and there's no felt presence of God, it might be kind of boring. But the fact is, when they were singing this song, people were engaged with God in a powerful way, in a tender but powerful way. You know, very much of the time, not every time, but God was moving. And so, you know, if you take it out of this genre and you go into whatever, a Gregorian chant, which is from a different age, and you know, you could describe that as boring, but people were experiencing God through it. And it's because it's meditative and contemplative, you give a lot of opportunity for listening and for being on the receiving end of what God might want to speak to you, and how he might be saying things to you that are completely outside of the text of what the song is saying. But because that the whole idea of two-way communication with God was right at the core of what they were doing, and they stumbled upon it, you know, and we all sort of stumbled upon it, and then we figured out, wow, God is speaking to us in the midst of this, and so let's give him room to do that. And he can do that through fast and medium and slow tempo music, but there was a big emphasis on the slower.
And to this day, the contemporary music, I love it. You have time to really think, and I hear what you're saying. I have thought too. That's the hymns that were 5 million words, which is big. Did you mean to know what you're saying? I see it differently.
Yeah, and I mean, teaching is a very important part of what worship is, but at this particular time in history, in this window of time, it was more about knowing God in a mysterious way, in the mystical way, the way Paul describes, you know, and the way Jesus talks about in John 14 and 15. You see a lot of strong rock and roll music now coming out of the vineyard, and you have for many years. So there's a lot of contrast between then and now, and all the different moods of worship that developed over the years.
One last for now?
It's sort of building on that. A lot of contemporary Christian music is essentially sort of stadium power rock ballads, right? There's an audience in mind and a scale. My experience of vineyard music was in the mid-80s in Britain, where what would happen, people would go to Spring Harvest, and they'd go to a vineyard conference, and they'd come back with their little cassette, and then we'd sit in our Bible study group and play this cassette and sing along, which is kind of weird, and then go, oh, I wish we could do this in the church, you know, what's wrong with this group? So when you were writing, here's the question, when you were writing this music, it's very intimate between the singer and God. Were you imagining it as music to be sung in intimate settings, or was it thinking of the large high school auditorium?
Well, all of these songs were written knowing that, I mean, maybe knowing is too strong of a word, but thinking that they would probably be sung on Sundays. So, and then carried on into the small groups. But usually they were sung a few times in a smaller setting, and then introduced to the whole church. But they, I mean, all of these with the first time, we haven't heard this one yet, but the first time that Eddie sang I Only Want to Love You, I mean, it was at the service, and it was intended for that people. And even though there were that many people there, it felt like an intimate setting. I don't know how to describe that to you, but if there was just, that would be the word that would capture it.
Because there's some songs where you'd sing, and if you sang them in a small group, you'd feel terribly self-conscious, like this isn't quite working. I can't think of stuff. Whereas these songs work in small groups, I think.
But they really work
when
the presence of God is there strongly. And having led worship in many, many small groups, I know there have been many, many times where if the people are not engaged in worship, or not responding, they don't work. You feel like it's falling flat. So, any of you worship leaders experience that? And so, you know, since we're highlighting this time in history, it's just always important to reemphasize, you know, because the favor of God was on us, we could do these very simple songs, sing them over and over again, which to the uninitiated seems like, well, that's boring, you know, slow, repetitive. I just sang it. In fact, that was Wimber's response when he came home from traveling out doing his church growth seminars, and he came home and saw what was happening in his own living room. He was like, do I really have to sing like this? And then he caught it. He caught, you know, one of his sayings was, things of the Spirit are more easily caught than taught. So, just sitting in it, if you're sensitive to God and hungry for God, you catch it, and then you buy into it, and you participate in it. And so that was kind of the process.
I think that when you're in a small group and you're introducing it there, there's a feel that happens where you understand there's something on this song. I'll use the language on this song where there's... And then it's, you know, a given when you're going into a bigger group. But Andy's right. It was a time. I mean, we did sing these songs over and over and over.
And I mean, we still experience that and have for decades. You know, but this was an extraordinary time, you know, in not just in the Anaheim Vineyard, but in many, many, many other churches around the world. You know, I think it's easy to argue that this was a time of worldwide outpouring. To, you know, a friend of mine who was pastoring Calvary Chapel in that time said, in Southern California, said, it's so easy to lead people to Jesus, it's like falling off a log. You know, so that was part of the thing God was doing in Southern California at that time.
We left this from the 1982 album in here so that we could emphasize that intimacy that Cindy mentioned earlier. The difference between this song and the earlier one was exactly that language of talking to God in the song. So we'll play this, and then we've got a couple other questions. can we ask you what you would categorize as some of the strengths of the vineyard at this time? We've mentioned a few, but help kind of guide us in thinking about some of the highlights.
Well, I mean, obviously intimacy, knowing God personally. In terms of core values in the musical worship, an important thing was not manipulating people, not using what Wimber would call hype, but to, in order to allow for the heart connection with God to happen, to not let the power of the instruments eclipse the tender kind of exchange of love that was happening between people and God.
That manipulating thing, one thing that you'll notice in Vineyard, if you listen to that set, if you really listen to that 1982 service, is that there's no talking in between the songs at all. And the reason for that is because we were, the thought was that we're not going to tell anybody what to do or how to think, that we're just leaving this open for God to speak to someone during the service or for them to be able to be worshiping on their own. So we have the full set with no talking in between. And that, there was a value for both saying, having I statements, I feel like this, I think this, I, instead of we should all think this, or we should all do this. And then the other thing that I was thinking of is, I don't know why I thought of this now, but of loving the whole church, of this being the whole church. So anyone that came into our midst, and there were a lot of visitors from countries, but also from other churches, they were embraced and loved on regardless of where they came from. And then there was no talking against other churches in those settings. So loving the whole church, the bells and the smells is what John Wilson talked about. We love everybody, even the bells and the smells. And we were, as you saw, very casual. And one of the slogans was, come as you are. You can be here.
Can I do a follow-up question there? As I was working on the book with y'all, and I was listening to audio tapes of John Wimber preaching, and we transcribed one of them, or several of them actually, but his Loving God sermon, that we have most of that sermon in the book itself. One of the things that really struck me was his emphasis generally on love, the connection of worship and love, but worship dependent upon the worshiper having love for God. And that struck me because, you know, I've heard pastors, particularly those in really large churches, who just almost want to seem to count numbers. But John Wimber doesn't strike me like that. In fact, in the sermon, he actually says, you know, if you don't have love for God, I'm not sure why you would be here. Let me see if I can frame the question. Is my perception accurate that he's very concerned, not just with the worshiper having a good experience, but the worshiper actually having love for God?
Yeah, and the point is to bless God. And, you know, let's get to the end of a service and somebody says, oh, worship wasn't that great for me today. And, you know, he would correct that from the pulpit and say, well, worship is for God. Even though we're talking about how blessed we were and the experience of receiving a blessing while worshiping, really, first and foremost, we're there to bless God. And then you may feel like you're lifted up into heaven, or you may not. And so, yeah, that was a high value for John, that, you know, it's not a, I'm here to get my goosebumps, you know. And if you look in church history, you see repeatedly people that were in renewal made this mistake of not seeking Jesus, but seeking an experience. And it's very easy to do that. If something extraordinary is happening, then you can get off balance. You can get off point that way. And so worship was a way of offering ourselves to God. And you can't really, even though, again, this God was faithful to minister to us, it can vary for different individuals between a very gentle experience of God's peace or just being blasted, you know, emotionally, spiritually, physically experiencing God.
One of the sections in each of the books that are coming around is a section where people, we look for descriptions of worship and firsthand accounts. And as we were putting together this volume, Cindy actually did a bunch of interviews with people who were there, and both of you have stories that you've shared with us about experiences that are sort of representative of this piece in history. And I'm wondering if you can share a few of those with us.
The first one that comes to mind is one thing that we saw was that during, I'm going to stand so you can see me, during worship, often people would come, and as they were singing, there were sovereign times when God moved sovereignly on someone just by themselves in their song. So, for example, one time my husband was, I don't even think he was thinking of anything in particular, but we began worship, and he closed his eyes, and for the entire time during worship, there was a scene from his life that was particularly painful. And Jesus walked beside him and took him through that whole scene. And it was as if it reshaped, transformed that particular moment in his life. And when we finished, he was crying, and I thought, oh, gosh, what happened to you? And then he told me, about what had gone on. And I said, Did you expect that? Were you asking that? He said, no, I wasn't even thinking about that. It's just that as I began to worship, it was out in front of me. And then I have another friend who came into the service because his sister would not leave him alone, so he just wanted to get her off of his back, so he just came to kind of pacify her. And during worship, his language was, I met Jesus. But nobody was talking to him. It was just the songs, and by the time we finished, he was crying and couldn't stop crying. Those were just common things. Also, healing happened often during worship. Someone would come with the intent maybe to get prayer, but as they were worshiping, healing would happen without anyone touching them or laying hands on them. And then delivered. Also, at the end of the service, there was a quiet time that John would give at the end where we would wait on God. That would be the quicker influence. And we would wait on the Lord to see what would happen. And often there were things that happened, like somebody would scream out, or there was one guy that did like a flip from a sitting position and fell on the floor. And John would always bring that back in and say, don't worry about that. They're just getting freed. Let's go back to this. And even though it's so weird, it's so awkward, and I mean, we just never seen anything like that, so we didn't know what to do with it. John always brought that back into it and said, Jesus is delivering them. We're going to bless that. And then we move on. So things were always happening in worship, and I think it's like what Andy said, we're offering worship to God. We're going there to bless him, but the outpouring that comes as a result of that was
yeah, one other little story is a mother and father of somebody who was attending the Vineyard were sure that their kid was involved in some kind of cult. So they came to check it out, and for 5 straight Sundays they just cried the whole way through the worship because God was touching them and ministering to them, and so much for the cult.
I mean, still to this day, I know people who, one of my friends walked, she said to me, I'm going to come to church with you, just like this with her finger, I'm going to come to church with you, but when I don't like it, you still have to be my friend. Okay, you got it, I'm still your friend. And she walked in the door and the music had started, and she just started crying, and she cried for weeks and just could not stop crying every time she heard music and every time she walked in the door. It was just, and that still does happen.
The Kleenex company must have loved
her. They did. It's true.
Time is getting away from us quickly, but I'm seeing hands, and I want to give you guys the opportunity to ask questions. So let's kind of see what you've got.
I just wondered about the time of the services. Were you know, for those of us who are contained in a certain time element, how long did your services typically last? Was there a constraint, or did they just go until they were done?
Well, there was a sort of constraint because of children's ministry, right? So that usually it was about making sure that we were done in time to take care of the kids and to lead the people who were taking care of the kids, honestly. Yeah. So there was, but that said, the ministry time, so the service would last a certain amount of time, but the ministry time would go on for a long time,
okay.
Right? And then you always, the thing that was said at the end of it was, if you know someone who's getting ministry, or if you're going to go get prayer or whatever, you need to make sure the kids are taken care of. So go get your kids, and then you can stay for how long as you want.
And there's a particular emphasis on a long, uninterrupted time of worship to let this two-way conversation have its full play, and to really give space for people to connect with God. That's the whole crux of why people were being transformed, is they were being touched by God. Somebody in the back over here had their hand up. Yeah.
Please permit me to start.
Yeah.
I don't know if I understood the topic of the seminar well. Loving God intimately, worshiped, and held communion. I appreciate all what has been said here, but I should be able to toss somebody out there. This is what, if you do during worship, will help you have an intimate relationship with God. But from all what I've been said here, I don't think if somebody approaches me and says, how can you love God intimately during worship? I don't think if I have anything I can tell the person. So it would be good if I have some keywords or key
right.
points
yeah.
that I can be able to tell
might
somebody,
be,
this is what you can do in worship that will bring that intimate relationship between you and God, or will enable you to love God intimately.
Yeah, you might be stumbling over the word intimate, which I totally understand, because usually that word is used between a relationship with a husband and wife. But what the way we're using it is to describe what Jesus talks about in where he says, I'm going to reveal myself to you. I'm going to make my home in you, and you're going to make your home in me. And where Paul talks about, he prays for his church in Ephesus, for example, where he says, I pray that you will continually experience the love and power of Jesus Christ. And so that's what we mean. And so, and time's almost gone, but there's one of the related issues that we haven't even touched on is, in order to be intimate with someone, you have to make yourself vulnerable to them. Jesus made himself vulnerable by dying for us. And so part of our response, and you see this in the Psalms, is you completely unmask yourself, and you are completely honest and open, and you reveal yourself like Psalm 51. And when you do that, you become intimate with God. There's no barriers between, so worship is not a place to hide from God. It's not a place to put on a show for God. It's rather a place, although there's a place for performance. Worship's a huge subject. But the kind of worship we're talking about here is where you bow down, you repent, you say, God, I want to hear from you. see if there be any wicked way in me, search my heart. So that's what we mean by intimacy. It's us opening the door for, Lord, have your way with me. You see, you, like Isaiah, you know, in repentance. I totally understand, though, especially if you're from a different culture, that that idea might be a strange one. Yeah.
So I don't mean this as a critique of the Institute at all, but you know, I'm just wondering what it feels like to be an object of a scholarly study on worship and sort of a historical curiosity. I mean, there's a sense in which you're still all about the same stuff that you were about in the 80s.
Well,
and then I have a second question. Just I want to know what the official tempo of In the Secret
is. That's great.
Well, actually, though, you know, what God was doing here is being expressed through Chris Tomlin and Matt Redman and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in different forms. And I don't know Chris's story, but I know that Matt's story is very strongly influenced by the Vineyard. And so the essence of what we had and have, he has. And in part because when he was like 11, 12, 13 years old, Vineyard teams, including Cindy and me and many others, would go over to England and do worship and the whole package of teaching and healing. And that was that profoundly shaped who Matt became, you know, and along with many other influences in his life. I mean, England itself is a whole wellspring of richness in worship. You know, that where Cindy and I are both sort of like, you got to be kidding me. You know, they picked Anaheim Vineyard, and how did we end up there? Well, it's just because we live near there, and we were in a certain place in a certain time, and God had his hand on the church, and so we got swept up into what he was doing, and not because we were exceptionally smart or gifted, but just God's blessing.
If I can just add there, I mean, for those of us who were outsiders going in and trying to build a collaborative relationship, I mean, I hope everyone involved experienced it as a respectful sort of experience. And I will add, the Vineyard had been under scholarly microscope for since, you know, the early 80s, not always in a sympathetic or appreciative tone. And that was something that we wanted to write a solid history, but it had to be a sympathetic history.
Yeah. Oh, I totally feel like you did that. Yeah.
Can I just say one of the best things about this is just being able to say, this is just what happened. Mm-hmm. Not defending it, just saying, this is just the way it was. This is what we were experiencing. This is what was happening during that time. So that's been a gift for me.
Question: was this when you started out with the writing of the music and the, I don't want to say performance, but for lack of the other term, the execution of the music? What were you expecting to happen within the congregation?
Well,
or was there an expectation?
Yeah, participation. You know, like the goal, one of the biggest goals is accessibility. So how can we play our instruments in such a way that it's going to invite participation and make it easy for people to participate?
And with that participation, was there a set tone? Should your hands be raised? If I go back to my sister's question, should your hand be raised? Should you be standing? Should you be seated? Should you be prostrated? Are you kneeling? I mean, what?
Right. There were, it was Any and all of the above, whenever you want to sit or stand or lie on the ground prostrate, or, and you know, if you had sky riders, whatever. It was like, do all of the above whenever and if you want, but we're not going to force you to do that. We're not going to, you might be invited to do that, but there was very little prompting, like Lester mentioned. It was just
the
sort
most
of
prompting was standing, the stand start,
right,
or something, you know.
And the fact that the leadership was modeling worship, so that the pastor of the church was in the worship team, and he was fully releasing what was happening and blessing and giving tons of space and time for it. And I don't know, in the very early years, did he teach on physically expressing worship?
We talked about lifting our hands and how the Psalms said it, and that the Psalms say to lift our hands and, you know, bow down. And so there was teaching on for us to do these things, especially if we were singing those words, that we could follow along with our physical actions.
And sometimes, you know, explosive joy did rumble up. I mean, when you've met with God and experienced God's love, naturally leads towards joy, you know, in some cases. And so we're not devoid of joyful songs. All we've given you here is a few snapshots of the tender, soft, gentle ones.
Cindy, can that work in your current setting, in more of a church, we'll say, Anglican or Episcopalian sort of setting? Will you leave the space for intimacy that seems like that's one side of worship in a way?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, that the difference of that. What I've noticed lately is that those people are being caught up the same way in the songs that I'm writing in this context, the same way as it was back in that part. And I'm not sure why that happens, except that it's very simple. So there's a simplicity to it where I feel like people are engaging in the same way that we did back then. That's the only, and it's funny that you asked that, because I've been thinking about that a lot lately, wondering why now suddenly there's the engagement. And then I thought, oh, everything we're doing is three lines.
Well, thank you very much for sharing with us today.
Mm-hmm.